which is Unite the Parks. Unite the Parks as appellants versus United States Forest Service. Looks like we've got a cast of thousands on this argument. So again, I'll repeat, though you might have already heard it, that we do appreciate that each of you has braved the pandemic to give us remote argument when the panel needs your advocacy in cases of this complexity and importance. So I'll thank you in advance on behalf of myself and Judges Bennett and Judge Nelson. We can proceed with this case. The argument is set for 20 minutes per side, and for the appellants, we've got three appellant counsel. I think Mr. Meyer and Siddharth Frederick, or Sydney, rather.
Yes, Ms. Frederick, Your Honor, thank you.
Ms. Frederick. And Mr. Voss. So my eyes have...
Yes, Your Honor.
My eyes have gotten a little worse at reading names on the docket. So I apologize if I mispronounced anyone's name. But for the appellee side of the case, for the Forest Service, we have this says Rebecca Jaffe. Is that correct? Rebecca Jaffe?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
Okay. Okay, now, Ms. Fitzgerald, is there any counsel here who I've left out?
No, that is it.
Okay. So, why don't we proceed with argument from Mr. Meyer. First is set for 8 minutes. And if you could let us know whether you plan to make a rebuttal argument and what you'd like to reserve.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Meyer, and along with my co-counsel, Sydney Frederick and Renee Voss, I represent the appellant in this matter. I will argue why the biological opinion at issue in this case failed to comport with the ESA, while Ms. Frederick will handle our NEPA claims, Ms. Frederick and I will each take 8 minutes, and that will, of course, be 16 minutes, and we will set aside the remaining four of our 20 for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case involves a programmatic biological opinion authorizing a series of logging projects in the habitat of an endangered species, the Pacific Fisher. Now, the Wildlife Service issued this programmatic opinion, even though the service does not know how many fishers remain, and even though the proposed projects will cause considerable short-term harm to the species. The lower court's conclusion that this opinion comported with the Endangered Species Act and that a preliminary injunction was therefore inappropriate is flawed for two reasons. First, the opinion violates the Wildlife Service's obligation to evaluate the current status of an endangered species before issuing a no jeopardy determination. And second, the opinion fails to consider recent science undercutting its assertion that the proposed projects will, in the long term, improve the health of the forest and therefore improve long-term outcomes for the species itself. Now, on the current status question, Your Honors, we believe there are three central facts that resolve this case. The first is that the Wildlife Service does not know the current status of the fisher. As the government notes on page 21 of its brief, the most recent estimate of fisher population extrapolates from measurements of fisher habitat from before 2010. Effectively, that study looks at the extant amount of the existing
fish. Can I ask you about that? Because if that's all the data that it currently, if that's the current estimate of the population that it still has, we've been very clear that best science does not require them to do additional studies. Now, your argument seems to be that they had new estimates. Where is that new estimate that they overlooked?
So the new estimate that they overlooked, Your Honor, is data that was collected by the Forest Service after the wildfires in 2020. And what that Forest Service data effectively was a remotely sensed survey of the extant vegetation, the extant habitat, the same data that that pre-2010 data essentially was.
So and that I wanted data provided, can I take you to ER 1853? This is the biop, and it says this although the earlier Fisher habitat models were based entirely on vegetation data collected in 2012 or earlier, and do not accurately portray current post-drought habitat conditions, the 2020 interim models have been updated to include some post-drought data and are the best available at this time until additional post-drought Fisher and vegetation data is available. That suggests that it was more than just the vegetation data that's going into these models, that there's some post-drought data that that was not part of the 2012 model. Are you contending that the Fish and Wildlife Service had both updated vegetation data as well as post-drought data?
Your Honor, our primary submission here is that the 2020 vegetation data, by not using that data and rolling it into the existing population models, the Fish and Wildlife Service, by definition, did not use the best available data, because as this court made clear in Burford, an agency cannot ignore available biological information.
Well, hold on a second. I want to back up. You said they didn't use the best available data. That's not the legal standard. The legal standard is the best available science. So, I mean, if they had this vegetation data and their response seemed to be, this is not just a plug and play where you just enter the vegetation data and it shoots out a population number. In fact, if I correct me if I'm wrong, but the 2012 estimate for population for the Fishers was between 100 and 500. Like, that's a pretty broad range. It's not like they were plugging this in and getting some data number that was, hey, there's 353. So what do you think the baseline was going to show if they, I mean, first of all, what had to be done? And then what was it going to show to the baseline to give more accurate information than the 2012 population data?
So I think there's a few questions there, Your Honor. So if I may, I'll try to address each of them. As we read the ESA and its implementing regulations, the language that the regulations use is indeed the best available scientific or commercial data. And so we don't accept the Wildlife Service's contention that because the data was not yet modeled or translated into some sort of legible form, that the Wildlife Service was effectively authorized to ignore it. And we believe that that is justified by the fact that if that were indeed the rule, then it would create a perverse incentive for agencies to never incorporate raw data into existing models and leave those models perpetually outdated. But to Your Honor's other point about the range question, what we would submit is that even if the initial estimates were a range, and we believe the median number that the government admits in its brief is most likely is somewhere under 300 animals, the fact is that all of those numbers are still based on a survey of vegetation from before 2010. And the problem with that is that, as we know from data collected from before and after the wildfires in 2020, 55% of that habitat has been altered in some way, either by wildfire or by drought.
What if the record showed, and I'm going to be asking counsel for the government what the record does show, but if the record hypothetically showed that for this remotely sensed vegetation habitat data layer, that it would have taken 3 years with all deliberate speed to translate that data into a new population scientific estimate. Would your position be that they can't do anything for that 3 years, even if the district court correctly found that 3 years is reasonable because this isn't plug and play?
So again, a few notes on that, Your Honor. And again, I appreciate, as you stated in the premise of your question, we don't think that that's clear from the record. And in fact, as the government notes in footnote 2 of their brief, the Wildlife Service is not required to create any new models or really gather any new data at all. But to address the crux of your question, our argument in that situation would be that the Wildlife Service would have to wait those 3 years. And the reason for this is that the current status analysis and the best available data analysis are not necessarily the same thing. The government could very well have the best available data, but that data may not provide an accurate representation of the fisher's current status.
So even if waiting 3 years, even if the government determined that they couldn't wait because whatever the population was waiting would harm the fisher, they'd still, in your view, they'd still have to wait?
In our view, the government would still have to wait precisely because it would not know the current status of the fisher.
Even if that would wipe out the fisher, they'd still have to wait because that's what the law required, even if that were ultimately extremely harmful to the fisher.
Well, Your Honor, we don't think that on the record here, that sort of delay would be harmful to the fisher, precisely because, as the biological opinion makes clear, in the short term, these actions are far more likely to harm the fisher than they are to help it. All of the government's proposed benefits are on a much larger time frame. For example, the government claims that fire resilience benefits from these projects will help the fisher over the course of the next 30 years. But in the short term, not pursuing these projects is probably in the best interest of the fisher rather than pursuing
it. Isn't that exactly what they should be able to weigh? Is what the short-term and the long-term benefits are going to be. I mean, we see these cases all the time that come up. There's this, you know, they're trying to prevent future fires and they're trying to take actions to remedy that. And I think there's agreement that reducing fires will actually benefit the fishers. But now we get plaintiffs in here trying to enjoin actions that are actually going to, over the long haul, reduce fires, which are actually going to pose a harm to the fishers. That seems like that's exactly what the Fish and Wildlife Service is supposed to be able to consider and balance.
So 2 points on that, Your Honor, and I see that I'm running out of time. So if the panel has further questions, I'm, of course, happy to answer. If not, I do want to defer to Ms. Frederick on the NEPA claims. But 2 points on that. The first is that the assumption that in the long term these proposed projects will lead to improved fire resilience. And this is, I believe, the crux of our second ESA claim. The Wildlife Service has not actually engaged with science that does suggest that might not actually be the case. So we would, I suppose, object to the premise of the question, which is that the Wildlife Service has reached this determination about long-term effects in a reasonable way. But more importantly, and this goes to the current status question, we would contest that a predicate of engaging in that sort of weighing analysis is knowing the current status of the fisher and knowing how many species currently exist, which the Wildlife Service has admitted, and the government admits in its briefing, that the government simply does not know. And so in order to engage in that weighing analysis in a meaningful way to determine, for example, how many fisher will recover, how many fisher will remain, how many fisher the government can acceptably take in order to get those long-term benefits, the government needs to meet that threshold step of knowing how many fishers there are. And by their own admission, they simply do not know that. And as a result, any analyses that stem from a faulty baseline, that is a shaky foundation of a weak current status analysis, must be viewed with skepticism. I do see that I've intruded on my colleague's time. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd like to defer to Ms. Frederick to discuss the NEPA claims. Thank you very much.
Well, I have one question for you.
Please.
My question is, did litigation relating to the ESA, how common is it for habitat data like vegetation to be used as a proxy for determining the number of a species that exists?
I can't speak to the commonality in the run of ESA cases, Your Honor, but what I can say is that using this sort of data to conduct effectively a carrying capacity estimate of a species' population is not an uncommon method at all for the Wildlife Service or other government agencies to use. And the reason for this is that a more rigorous analysis, for example, a population viability analysis, is often a far more involved process and can be very difficult, particularly in the case of a species like the fisher, which is known for being quite furtive and sneaky and is therefore very difficult to count in a more robust way. So these sorts of methods are useful proxies for determining the overall scope of a species' population.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
I think we should turn to Ms. Frederick.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. This is Sydney Frederick on behalf of the appellants. The Forest Service needs to analyze the cumulative effects of its 31 projects in light of recent significant events. And until they do so, NEPA requires that these projects be enjoined. Our NEPA claim begins with the regulation directing agencies to conduct supplemental environmental review when there are significant new circumstances relevant to environmental concerns and bearing on a proposed action or its impacts. That circumstances have changed on these forests is not really what's in dispute here. The Forest Service has acknowledged the need to take a second look at its project's environmental impact after recent events, recognizing that all 31 of the challenged projects are ongoing discretionary actions that are still subject to NEPA supplementation requirements. The Forest Service's core
Council,
failure...
Can I ask one question? Because I was trying to put the NEPA claims into context, and it seems to me there's a fundamental disagreement about what NEPA requires. The government seems to claim that you have to challenge an individual NEPA document for a specific action, and that you haven't done that here. You've just said we're challenging the cumulative effects of all 30 of these. Have you pointed to specific NEPA documents for specific projects and challenged those as insufficient under NEPA?
We have not done that here, Your Honor. We haven't highlighted any one particular project document, but in this case, that's because they all share one common problem here, which is that none includes a cumulative impacts analysis that evaluates all these projects' impact after the Fisher's listing and the fires.
Okay.
The Forest Service's core failure here, as I alluded to just now, is that it's declined to supplement the NEPA documentation for these projects with an analysis of these projects' cumulative effects. Ninth Circuit case law makes clear that when agencies prepare NEPA analyses, they have to evaluate cumulative impacts. These are the impacts that multiple projects could together have on an affected natural resource. And the case law also makes clear that agencies are obligated to analyze potential effects to natural resources at the spatial scales that are necessary to understand and protect those resources. Now, in this case, all 31 of the challenged projects have the potential to affect one common natural resource. That's the remaining habitat suitable for fishers on the Southern Sierra Nevada. The environmental impact statements done for the 2004 Sierra Nevada Forest Plan Amendment framework and the fisher conservation strategy that the Forest Service relies on in designing its projects both recognize this remaining habitat as a natural resource that needs to be managed on a landscape scale. And yet the Forest Service...
Can I ask a question about this? So, Your challenge to NEPA, it dovetails off of the fisher population, or are there other allegations about environmental impacts that were not considered?
Our argument here does not necessarily dovetail exactly with the ESA claims we're bringing. Our argument is that, you know, after these fires and the fisher's listing, we have a core question here, which is whether completing all these projects is going to allow us to maintain a sufficient amount of habitat for the fisher on this landscape, and that a cumulative impacts analysis is going to be a core aspect of how the Forest Service answers that question, but that it has neglected to do so here.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought critical habitat had not been designated for this population of the fisher. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. What has been established is a set of core habitat patches and linkage areas connecting them. The fisher conservation strategy designated prior to the fisher's listing and a baseline assumption, if you will, of where there is sufficient habitat for the fisher, considering that it requires multiple dispersed patches of habitat. For an example of a place where you can see that kind of conservation strategy laid out, where you can see all the different areas where the fisher was estimated to live in the fisher conservation strategy, you can see a map of those core and linkage areas at volume 4 of the excerpts of record from pages 691 to 93.
Council, is it possible for the government to do an appropriate cumulative impact analysis without having an up-to-date, viable, scientifically based estimate of the current population?
We would argue, Your Honor, that that's an important part of making sure that a cumulative impacts analysis here is as informative as it possibly can be.
But is it your view that they could still do one even on the state of the record without that information? That could they do one that would satisfy the law?
We do think that the agency could do a cumulative effects analysis that would be meaningful to some extent. But to be clear, we do think, and as my co-counsel has argued, that doing a proper cumulative effects analysis requires starting with an assessment of the fisher's baseline status.
Well, it does for the Endangered Species Act, but NEPA doesn't have that requirement, does it?
Well, Your Honor, the Lands Council case, the Lands Council versus Powell case that we cite in our brief at page 1031, discusses the fact that without some sense of a baseline status for a species, it's hard to really do an accurate cumulative effects analysis. That was the basis on which the court argued that the cumulative effects analysis in that case was insufficient. So there is some NEPA case law suggesting that starting with a baseline assessment of a species is an important part of doing a cumulative effects analysis.
I wanted to point you to ER 1888, and you're probably familiar with, even if you're not with the specific document, with the numbers. But it said that if we assume all fisher habitat that burned at high severity was lost or no longer available for fisher, the overall percentage of fisher habitat subject to Forest Service activities each year would increase from about 1% to about 1.2%. That suggests that it's a very marginal increase. I mean, 98.8% of fisher habitat isn't even going to be touched by Forest Service activities. Doesn't that help satisfy the Fish and Wildlife Service, any NEPA obligation that it has to say that they're just not, there's just such a low impact on the habitat that there can't be, that no cumulative effect could create the kind of impact that you're suggesting?
Well, two responses to that, Your Honor. First, just briefly, we would point you to pages 50 to 51 of our opening brief for a specific discussion of how we would respond to that particular contention on the part of the Forest Service. But to summarize our response to that argument, over half of the fisher's habitat, as my co-counsel argued, has been altered by the combined effect of drought and fire since the 2011 population estimate. And we know from the fisher listing decision that it's cumulative impacts of the fisher, not any one action or problem that is its, core threat here. And so any project that the Forest Service carries out, first of all, these are going to be projects that are carried out over the course of multiple years. So that's, if a project takes about 10 years to complete, it could end up having an additional 20% of a negative, it could end up altering an additional 20% of the fisher's habitat by the time it's done. When you take into account all these effects that are having a compounding negative effect on the fisher's habitat, that is where the harm to the fisher comes from here. And so any argument that any individual one of these projects will have a de minimis effect on the fisher's habitat, it fails to consider that aspect of the problem. And I see that I'm over my time. If there are no further questions, I would like to make sure that we ensure a sufficient amount of time for rebuttal on both arguments.
Any questions now?
No, Judge Gould.
Okay, Judge Nelson.
No, thank you.
That's fine. Mr. Frederick, I guess we'll turn to Mr. Voss, who's sort of batting cleanup for the appellants.
Your Honor, I wanted to reserve my time for rebuttal, 4 minutes.
Okay. Then that's fine. Then I think we'll turn to Ms. Chaffee. And I'm going to let the appellants have the time they planned for rebuttal. So, Ms. Chaffee, if you need a few more minutes, you can just ask me and you'll get it. Please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Rebecca Jaffe appearing on behalf of the United States. First, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service properly evaluated the current status and environmental baseline of the fisher. The agencies considered all relevant existing data, including the older population estimates that have been referenced. In addition, population occupancy and monitoring data up through 2019, population trend data up through 2015, population trend studies up through 2018, and on-the-ground field visits up through 2020. A census population count, where you count each individual member of the species, is not required to determine the current status and environmental baseline under the Endangered Species Act. And two DC Circuit cases have held this specifically. The first is
Council. I am interested in all this, but the main contention here seems to be that there was vegetation data that could have been used. Could you explain? I think the panel would benefit from an explanation of what actually had to be done here, because it's not precisely explained in the declaration of I forget the expert's name, but could you walk us through what actually has to be done? Is it plug and play, or is there more that has to happen in the modeling to use the vegetation data to get a population estimate?
Yes, Your Honor. It is absolutely not plug and play, and there is a lot more that needs to happen in a couple different arenas. First, there's the type of data that you have. So the data that plaintiffs are referencing, the 2020 ravage data, which is the post-fire data, that's it's a rough data set that the Forest Service develops quickly after a fire to get a sense of what's the severity with which areas burned. Was it a high severity burn here? It's not granular data. And in fact, when the Forest Service goes back a year later to do the same assessment of what areas burned at high severity a year later, they'll see, oh, things are growing where we didn't realize, we thought everything was dead. So it's a
rough. I want you to be able to continue to answer Judge Nelson's question. But my question is, I'd like you to not just answer Judge Nelson's question, but tell me where all this is in the record, because I've read Mr. Kuiper's or Dr. Kuiper's declaration talking about the data. I've tried to read as much of the record as I could. I've read your sites. I've read the discussion about Dr. Sawyer, if she is Dr. Sawyer, and the references to where this is, but I can't find anything in the record that talks about what it would actually take to translate the remotely sensed vegetation habitat data into an updated population estimate. And I might have missed it, but I'd like you, in answering Judge Nelson's question as to what it would take, to also tell us where in the record that is.
It is not in the record.
And so how can we uphold the position of the Forest Service that we didn't have the best available science, when, at least as the way I read Dr. Kuiper's declaration, it's possible to read that as saying all we do have to do is plug and play. The government's argument is this isn't the best available science because there's so much that has to be done, and yet the government chose not to put in the record exactly what had to be done.
So I have a couple responses to this, Your Honor. My first point is that the district court noted in its opinion at 1 ER21 that plaintiff's claims evolved during the course of the briefing. And originally plaintiff's argument was you don't have an updated population estimate. And that was the focus of the government in its declarations. In the reply and at argument, at the preliminary injunction argument, and now on appeal, plaintiffs are saying, well, you had the data and you could have done it. So the evolution of the case, so I would point the court to 1 ER21 where the district court said plaintiff's claims have evolved over the course of this
case. Well, I understand what the district court said, and I understand what the plaintiff's arguments were, but you chose, by the way, do I have it right? Is it Dr. Kuiper?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So You chose to put in Dr. Kuiper's declaration, and I'm looking at the page everybody cites to, ER 619. We used the population estimates, the prior ones, using Spencer's method. It wasn't available at the time of our listing rule and our 2020 PBO. It was available for the 2021 PBO, and people, including Dr. And people are using it. And you told the district court one of the people, I guess, was Dr. Sawyer. So you have those facts in there, and you chose not to explain to the court how you got from A to B. And if the answer had been, it's really easy to get from A to B, and if we had wanted to, we could have plugged it in and told you that the Fisher population is 300. Why isn't it the government's problem, not the plaintiff's problem, that the government chose not to put that in Dr. Kuiper's deck? Because surely he knew what it would have taken, right?
First of all, I would actually say that I don't know that Mr. Kuiper would have known that information, because he's actually not one of the people doing the models. But in any event, to respond to your question, first of all, plaintiffs bear a burden of showing the likelihood of success on the merits, and they need to point to studies that the Fish and Wildlife Service ignored. They can't make arguments and then prevail on an abuse of discretion standard on appeal on the basis of one sentence in a declaration and say, well, look, this sentence suggests that there's information that the Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service could have used but didn't. The fact of the matter is that it's not plug and play data. The Conservation Biology Institute was working.
But where do we go to find that? Is it in the conservation? You were going to the Conservation Biology Institute. Do they say it's not plug and play?
That is not in the record, Your Honor. And
there's nothing in the record that says it's not plug and play?
There's nothing in the record that says it's not plug in the play, but the standard isn't that the United States needs to explain in every instance why plaintiff's assertions about what is possible isn't possible.
And I'm sorry.
But I just wanted to say, Jeffy, I want you to answer fully Judge Bennett's question and Judge Nelson's question. But I wanted you to know that when you're done with that, I'd like to interject a question of my own.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's the explanation of why it's not plug and play isn't in the record. And the best I can say at this time is that if that's something the court wants, we can provide that via a 28J letter. But at the end of the day, what constitutes the best scientific and commercial data available is itself a scientific determination and warrants substantial deference. And the Ninth Circuit held that as recently as 2020 in National Farm Coalition 966F3893. And we are on an abuse of discretion standard here. There's one sentence in the Kuiper Declaration that says the Conservation Biology Institute is working with raw habitat data layers. And it was to update a Fisher reproductive habitat model. And that data, though, could not be plugged into the population estimate models that were used in 2011, because those models use different habitat parameters. They looked at Fisher habitat generally.
So what should the plaintiffs have done? Well, I Judge Gould, you had a question. Why don't you go ahead?
My question is related, but a little different slant. So let me pose it now. I thought the Supreme Court in its State Farm decision said that one reason why an agency decision can be arbitrary and capricious is if the agency ignored or did not address an important part of the problem before it. If I'm right in that, my question is, in a case where the agency's prior data was from 2012 and there's now new data from 2020, why isn't the agency ignoring an important part of the problem if they don't address, either use the new data or address why it's impractical to do that?
2 points in response, Your Honor. The first is that the agency relied on a host of data that was much more recent than 2012. It used population occupancy and monitoring data up through 2019, population transit.
Where's that in the record?
For those dates, I would direct the court to the response. Yes, to the revised programmatic biological opinion, which starts at 8 ER 1843, and also to the United States' response to plaintiffs' first and second notices of intent to sue under the agents under the Endangered Species Act, and that's at 2 ER 36. And that leads into my second response to Judge Gould, which is, there's also Vermont Yankee, which says that plaintiffs can't save their objections and bring them up at litigation for the first time. In their notice of intent to sue, plaintiffs weren't saying there's data that you could be using to do more. That came up in litigation, frankly, after the United States had even filed the declarations. And so the United States didn't have an opportunity because that wasn't an argument presented to it. But the response to the first and second notices of intent to sue, which is at 2 ER 36, responds to the arguments that plaintiffs are making in other respects, including that the United States needed to have an updated census population count. And the response explains that we're using different types of data, population occupancy and monitoring data, trend data. And Judge Nelson, this was about 10 minutes back, but you mentioned that you would like those cases from the DC Circuit, which specifically say that you don't need to have a census population count. And that's,
well, I think we agree. Well, I don't know. I don't want to speak for everyone else, but I think we agree you don't have to have a census count if it doesn't exist. The problem is, if you have data by which you can get a census count, where's the fault line? And I think that's what the panel is trying to flesh out here. If the vegetation data from 2020 didn't exist, I think this would be an entirely different case. I think you'd say the best available science is everything else we use. But now you have this 2020 vegetation data, and it's confusing as to what should have been done with it legally.
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize that it's confusing. The fact of the matter is that the 2020 vegetation data was to model fisher reproductive habitat, and it couldn't be used to create a census population estimate. The models that did that were not focused solely on reproductive habitat.
So is Dr. Kuiper's declaration incorrect? Because I thought he...
I do not believe so, Your Honor. He says that the raw habitat data layer was available and fisher experts were using the newly available data to update habitat models and population trends appropriately for use in our analyses. And
population trends is irrelevant to population?
They are different concepts, Your Honor.
Well, the other thing that I'm looking at, counsel, when your colleague in the district court, Ms. McNeil, was arguing, and this is at SCR 68, which you might have actually cited, where there was a reference to Dr. Kuiper, and there was a statement by your colleague that something that someone said about the data being available might have been an overstatement. And then what your colleague goes on to say is, the update isn't being performed by Fish and Wildlife. It's being performed by the Conservation Biology Institute, which is a separate entity. But Sarah Sawyer, the declarant, one of the declarants here, is one of those authors. And I mean, I'm reading, I don't remember how long it was, but like a long declaration from Ms. Sawyer, and maybe 20 pages. And there's nothing in there about the CBI study or data, and if it is so clear that it wasn't a plug and play, I just am baffled that the government decided not to provide that information to the district court, especially since it provided a 20-page declaration from one of the individuals who was, I guess, involved in crunching the data, according to SCR 68.
A couple points, Your Honor. One, I do want to go to the point you made about, is population trend data irrelevant to population? It's certainly not irrelevant, but it's a very different type of analysis. Population trend data uses monitoring data and occupancy data. For example, the Forest Service has over 200 monitoring locations where it catches pictures, hundreds of thousands of pictures a year, if not millions of photos. There's a bunch of statistical modeling that the Forest Service does to say, okay, the population is stable, or the population is increasing, or the population is decreasing. And that's very different than creating a census population count. So I do want to clarify that those are two different concepts. And then to your point about, you know, shouldn't the government have made it more clear? I apologize for that, Your Honor. I think that there, on appeal, there are three narrow issues being argued, but at the time of the PI and at the speedy pace at which PI briefing was happening, there were a lot more issues on the table, and I don't think that the government realized that there was going to be this focus on this particular question of, can you take data that all of these scientists who are working on studying the fish are absolutely understand is not plug and play. I don't think there was an understanding that they would need to explain that and have it in the record for the court, because they were going to encounter this argument on appeal.
Okay, counsel, let me interject a question here. Sam, give me water. The question is this, and if this question is more or less precluded by some prior waiver of the appellants, which you sort of urged earlier that they had raised the issue, but if that's the case, you know, we'll check the law, and so be it. But assuming it's not precluded, what I'd like to know, trying to cut to the chase as well as I can, is if this were to go back to the agency on remand, and there was a limited remand, or like a focused remand, asking the agency to reassess population of the animal in light of the most current vegetation figures, how long would it take for the agency to do that?
So I have a couple points, Your Honor. First, this is a preliminary injunction appeal only on the likelihood of success on the merits issue, and plaintiffs have to establish all the factors, and it's an abuse of discretion standard. So I would first suggest that the case be remanded to the district court if the court were inclined to rule in plaintiff's favor to consider the remaining factors. But in any event, in response to your question, if the question was, agency, we need you to explain why you don't have an updated census population count, I think the agency could prepare that very quickly. If the question is, you need to prepare a new census population count, my understanding is that that type of study could take 4 to 5 years. The most recent, and this is not in the record, the most recent study that I have, that the scientists have told me about, that did a census population count, took 5 years. It was a different species. It was the Sierra Nevada red fox, but
counsel, I think how long would it take just to use the 2020 vegetation data to come up with some updated number? I mean, I understand you're saying if you want to do something else, but we all agree that that's not necessarily required. What would it take to use the 2020 vegetation data to come up with some number? How long would that take?
I'm not sure that that's even possible, Your Honor. The 2020 vegetation data was used to develop a model that spits out maps and says, okay, we have reproductive habitat here that meets the criteria we know in terms of the percentage of canopy cover that the denning fishers need, in terms of the type of species.
At least according to Dr. Kuiper, it can be used to get population trends. So what would that look like? That would just say population's increasing, population's decreasing.
Or population is stable, which is what the Forest Service has been finding and the Conservation Biology Institute have been finding in their studies. Okay. And that's a very different type of study. It's based on very different statistical modeling. The census population estimate modeling that was done in 2011 used assumptions about the size of fisher territory and the overlap between fisher territory, you know, how much one individual's fisher territory overlaps with another fisher's territory. And that the Forest Service has studies since then that indicate that the size of fisher territory may have changed. So they don't have information that they could just plug in about, well, we know we have this much habitat and we know they have this much territory and we know there's this much overlap now. So it's not just what's the quality of the habitat. There's other information that would be needed about, for example, the size of territory and the overlap. And a lot of the recent studies have not been focused on fisher habitat generally, but have been focused on fisher reproductive habitat, as the Forest Service sees that as most important for an indicator of the health of the species and in terms of.
So, counsel, if hypothetically we were to remand this to the district court as opposed to the agency for the government to supplement the information, including the non-plug-and-play nature that you've talked about and this additional information about why this data that isn't there or this information isn't there wouldn't directly translate and isn't something that based on current knowledge would change the agency's decision. I mean, no one likes to lose a case, but would there be any burden on the agency to do that other than the obvious of extra work and nobody likes to lose a case they think they ought to win?
I certainly think that the United States could provide information in declarations to the district court explaining why this data isn't plug and play. I would respectfully suggest that a limited remand to explain that would not necessarily be a loss for the United States, but I would want to say one thing that would be a tremendous burden on the United States would be having all of these projects enjoined, because they are really important for public safety. They're important for firefighter access. They're important for the long-term health of the fisher, and they're important for forest health. And so that would be a burden. I think it's very important for the Forest Service to be able to move forward with these projects and continue the important work that they're doing to improve forest health and mitigate the risks of catastrophic wildfires. I do want to make a quick point that I know plaintiffs have argued that the Forest Service is wrong about that science. And I would specifically point the court to two AR sites that discussed the extensive body of science indicating that fuels reduction improves landscape resilience and reduces high severity fire. And that's 8 ER 1888 and 2 ER 267-69. Also, insofar as plaintiffs suggest that the Fish and Wildlife Service refused to engage with plaintiffs' scientific studies, we would disagree with that characterization. And plaintiffs cite a quote from a response to a memo to file, which is at 2 ER 42, the plane where the Fish and Wildlife Service walks through studies that the plaintiffs had presented and says, we don't think that they're instructive for the following reasons. And the plaintiffs had also said, and we don't think that the models the Forest Service used to predict wildfire effects nationwide are accurate. And the Fish and Wildlife Service said, you know, the scope of the modeling program that the Forest Service uses nationwide is beyond the scope of this consultation about specific forest management projects.
Hey, Ms. Jaffe, I see you're 5 minutes or so beyond your allotted time, which of course is natural given the difficult questions posed by all of us to you. And I am giving appellants more time. So if you want any additional time right now, just tell me how much time you think you need, and then we'll go with that and set a limit, and you can conclude in your limit so that the appellants can make a rebuttal argument.
Your Honor, Renee Voss for the appellants. We'll ask for a couple extra minutes. I think we can wrap it up in 6 minutes. I just wanted to stress the last point, and that...
Did we miss something here, Judge?
Yes.
Was Ms. Jaffe done? I didn't understand.
Right, I had asked Ms. Jaffe how much time she needed.
If the court has any further questions about the NEPA argument, I haven't had an opportunity to address that. I do think our briefing discusses that in depth.
I have no questions about that, but I still have questions about how we could say that a Forest Service decision relying on data that's like about a decade old could be the best available science on the subject. That's really all my question. Just relates to the abuse of discretion standard and what the Supreme Court said in State Farm as to why the agency here, for reasons explored on our various questions, hasn't failed to address an important part of the problem. So why don't you take 2 minutes and answer, give your best shot at answering that, and then we'll go to the rebuttal argument.
First, the Endangered Species Act requires the best science available, and there was no census population estimate from more recent than 2011, and the Endangered Species Act does not require the agency to develop one. But the agency did rely on a lot more recent data, particularly, as I've mentioned, population occupancy and monitoring data. It looks at where the fish are at the different monitoring stations, takes genetic hair samples, camera photos, hundreds of thousands of photos a year. So that's data up through 2019. Population trend data and studies up through 2018, population trend data up through 2015, population trend studies up through 2018, and then on the ground field visits that are ongoing, but for purposes of the amended biological opinion, it was up to 2020, the end of 2020. And that was the best science available. And the agency has a lot of reasons why the data that the plaintiffs point to could not be used to plug and play. And I apologize for the fact that a lot of that explanation is coming from me and not something I can point to in the record. But the fact remains that the Endangered Species Act requires the best science available, not the best that folks wish it could be. And what constitutes the best scientific and commercial data available is itself a scientific determination that warrants substantial deference. And this court has upheld that determination most recently in 2020 at 966 F3D at 925. If the court has no further questions, I thank you very much for the generous allotment of time today.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Jaffe. We thank you. And important case. We will proceed to rebuttal argument. Now, Mr. Voss, I know you're making rebuttal. Is Ms. Frederick and Mr. Meyer, are they making rebuttal too?
Judge Gould, I'm going to refer one of my questions, on one of the rebuttal questions to Chris Meyer. But first, I want to apologize for my interruption, Judge Nelson.
Fine. This is pandemic days.
Also, I was probably not entirely clear in my comments. So no worries. Let's just proceed. You're going to argue.
I just wanted to make one quick point, and then I'll refer the ESA data question to Chris. The point is that if the court is considering remand, we also request that it issue an injunction pending the remand, because logging and the removal of large trees in these projects that would harm the fisher could start as early as May and June, depending on the project.
Well, the problem with issuing an injunction is, I mean, even if you're right on this narrow point, there's a whole bunch of other factors we'd have to go through that the district court considered. And that, I mean, a lot of those are factual determinations on abuse of discretion. So how do we get there? I mean,
sure, Your Honor.
In part because the complaint, if we rule in your favor on the population data, that's the only issue is a baseline starting point. And I understand that that's required by the regulation, but that doesn't seem to affect the substance of whether there's actually harm to the fisher overall. So that's a lot. Go ahead.
Yes, it's the basis of the needed relief, though, because if, you know, based on the estimates, the population is 55% lower, perhaps greater than reduced more than that, that makes a big difference. And in the meantime, the project could cause significant harm. But there is we have addressed the winter factors in our briefing.
But how can it cause significant harm when the Forest Service says it's only touching 1.2% of the fisher habitat? I guess I got to refer to the brief.
It's compounded over time, and that's not the only project. Plus, the 2021 fires have not been considered, even though we're not arguing that in this. The percentage at this point in time is actually going to be much greater than that. But we did argue the winter factors, and under the case law, Desert Citizens Against Pollution, the Bissen, and the recent case, Environmental Protection Information Center, Carlson, the court can weigh these factors and issue an injunction pending the remand. I would like to refer the rest of the data questions to Chris. So go ahead, Chris.
Thank you, Renee. Your Honors, just a few points on the ESA question. As an initial matter, as we've stated here and in our briefing, we want to emphasize that the current status inquiry and the best available data inquiry are not the same inquiry. There could be situations in which the government uses the best available data, but that data still does not provide an accurate representation of the current status. So that distinction, we believe, is important. And the reason we think it's important is because what the government is doing here is that they are trying to link best available data and current status and claim that as long as they use the best available data, their current status analysis is essentially immune from any further inquiry. But the problem with that is twofold. One, the service did not use the best available data, even if we want to argue on those grounds. As we stated, the 2020 vegetation data was not used. And as this court has, I think, made clear in its colloquy with respondent counsel, the agency does not provide a justification for why that data could not be used. Moreover, her argument, respondent counsel cited to a series of studies, for example, occupancy studies that she described as going up to 2018 that justify the agency's reliance on this pre-2010 data. The problem with that, Your Honors, is even though those studies are dated 2013 and 2018, for example, the Zelensky and Gray study was published in 2018, all of those studies still use pre-2010 data. The Zelensky and Gray study, which is about
habitat. Is there anything better? I mean, the only thing you've pointed us to is the 2020 vegetation data. You keep complaining about all these other studies that they're too old, but what's better?
So 2 points on that, Your Honor. One, it's certainly not our burden to flag any type of better science to the agency.
No, I actually think it is your burden, because the agency comes in, their burden is to use the best available science. They've said that this is the best available science. It seems like it is your burden to show that there is better science out there. This is not, ESA is not a NEPA claim. NEPA claims you can show all these other considerations they didn't make, but best available science seems different than that. A plaintiff has to come in and show that there's better available science. So what is the better available science?
Certainly, Your Honor. So on that front, we believe that the better available science is the 2020 data that was gathered by the Forest Service. And the reason we believe that is because, as this court noted in Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, an agency violates the best available data standard when it uses outdated data, in this case, the pre-2010 vegetation data, even though new data, in this case, the 2020 vegetation data, undercut the reliability of that older data. And that's precisely what's happened here. As we noted earlier, 55% of Fisher habitat has been altered since before that initial collection of vegetation data in pre-2010. And the agency has provided no justification either in terms of the manner in which that data would be used or the manner in which that data is not representative to justify not using the 2020 data to update its existing models, and therefore flies directly in the face of this course holding in Burford, where it stated that an agency may not ignore available biological information when projecting the impacts of an agency action. And the last point we'd like to make here, Your Honors, is that the service's claims that the vegetation data was difficult to model does not somehow immunize them from the obligation to use that best available data. As I stated earlier in my discussion with you, Judge Nelson, we don't believe that anything in the regulation, which speaks only to available data, necessarily states that that data only counts for purposes of best available data if it's plug and play or if it's able to be modeled in an efficient way. But on a more doctrinal front, we don't believe that there's any undue burden analysis that the government proposes that there is under the ESA. I mean, as the court made clear in TVA v. Hill, the protection of species is paramount, whatever the cost. And if the cost of that is asking the agency to invest a little bit more time to model data that is not plug and play, we don't believe there's any doctrinal basis for arguing that that creates such an undue burden on an agency that it can flout its foundational consultation obligation to determine the current status of a species before it issues a no jeopardy determination. Unless the court has any further questions, though, I think we're happy to.
I have no questions for you. However, I'd like to know if my colleagues do.
I don't, Judge Gould, but if you would indulge me for 30 seconds with a comment. And I mean, my general comment is to commend all counsel on their argument, but I'd particularly, if I may, Judge Gould, commend the counsel who are students. It was for me a delight to hear students arguing and to hear students who are so well prepared and did such an excellent job, and gives me more confidence in the future of the legal profession, and I am very appreciative.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
I agree with that. Let me say, I have two more brief comments, I hope. One is that I'd like to know if we're going to hear from Ms. Frederick any rebuttal on NEPA.
The city.
Well, Your Honor, the counsel from the DOJ didn't get a lot of opportunity to discuss their response to our NEPA argument, but there is one more point that I think it could be helpful to stress here, which is that we feel that the Forest Service's current approach to deciding whether there are environmental impacts worth considering here was not a reasonable exercise of its discretion, specifically because it limited its analysis of whether there are environmental impacts worth considering to the footprint of each individual project. And that's an approach that the Bark case we cite in our brief specifically calls out as an abuse of discretion from pages 872 to 873. I just wanted to make sure that I highlighted that point.
Thank you, Ms. Frederick. Well, my second comment relates to the point that Mr. Voss had mentioned, requesting that we issue injunctive relief. And I heard my colleague, Judge Nelson, saying he wasn't sure we have all the data and answers to do that on the other factors. So my comment is this, although I have no idea what our panel may decide to do after conference, but my comment is, if our panel were assumed to decide that we were going to remand to the district court for some purpose relating to this action, if we did that, or if we were going to remand to the agency, in either event, any party here could seek rehearing, which can cause further delay. And while they're seeking rehearing, if Mr. Voss is right, that there's like a ongoing risk to safety of the species, contrasted with the, you know, risks to the forest as the end to further burns that Ms. Jaffe mentioned. In either case, either whatever we do, any party can seek rehearing, or if they need an injunction, can file an emergency motion with our court seeking injunction. And that's dealt with by the court on either in a motions panel, or else it might be referred to us to decide. But if there's a motion for injunction, declarations with it could cover all of the issues that are pertinent. You know, I have no further comment, but I just want to thank all the council again. And I think everybody's had a chance to speak on behalf of their clients. But all the advocates have done an excellent job. I want to second Judge Bennett's comment that this gives us further faith in our excellent adversary system. So without further discussion, unless Judge Bennett or Judge Nelson wish to add more, I'll say this case is now submitted, and the court deputy should note it as submitted, and the parties will hear from us in due course. Okay. Many thanks, and we'll now adjourn for the day.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Hello. Thank you. This court for this session stands adjourned.